I did this trip 28th of May. I took off last year, so that was quite a memorable time for me because that was when Dave Witherford had died. I didn't know that he had died until I was in Brisbane about to get on a plane, and so sort of just wanted to take a moment to remember Dave because this trip for me is quite closely tied to Dave's death. That flight from Brisbane through to Dubai, it's over 14 hours, and we were taking off just after dark in Brisbane. And although we're flying like 900 kilometres an hour towards Dubai, the daylight went right round the earth and overtook us, lapped us, if you like, around the earth. So we arrive in Dubai just after dawn, you know. So I didn't get any sleep that night with the news of Dave's death and things. But yeah, so just remembering Dave. So the purpose of my trip, really, it's something I'd always wanted to go to Israel because it's a kind of a unique place. It's the birthplace of Christianity and, of course, Judaism. And Jerusalem's the third most holy place for Islam. So something about probably half the population of the earth hold Israel, or at least Jerusalem, as a special place. So it's kind of unique in that way. And I wanted to experience some of the cultural and the political situation and see, as Jeff said, you know, walk where Jesus walked and see some of the places that are mentioned in the Bible and get a feel for the geography and the, you know, the week before Jesus died, he walked from Jericho up to Jerusalem. And when you read that in the Bible, you think, oh yeah, okay. But when you see that you're going from 300 meters below sea level to 700 and something meters above sea level, that is one heck of a walk. And it's through a desert, there's no towns, there's nothing. It's not the sort of thing you do on a Sabbath. But that's a sermon for another day. So yeah, we flew into Dubai and then took another plane into Amman, Jordan, the capital of Jordan. And then we had arranged for a taxi to meet us at the airport and took us down to Petra. And we had the whole first afternoon looking around Petra. Then the next day went down to Wadi Rum, which is down southern Jordan there, and then crossed over into Israel at the north end of the Sea of Aqaba. There's only a few places you can go across from Jordan into Israel, and that one is more likely to be open on the day that you turn up. We could have gone across up near Amman, but they just close it. All of it, when unannounced, they just close the crossing quite often. And so we decided to do this other route, although it was further. So I'll just show you a quick look at Petra. Petra is quite a large place. The whole thing covers a few hundred square kilometres. It's a big valley surrounded by mountains, and it's really rugged mountains that you just. So there's only a couple of ways in, and the main entrance through is through the Sig, this narrow canyon, and so it made it a natural fortress. It was easy to defend, you see. And sort of having a bit of an engineering background, I quite like looking at things like that. This is a water system that brought water for a couple of kilometers from a little spring down into Petra. There's two of these. And these are terracotta tiles, half round tiles that they'd baked and made this water system. And that was one of the keys to this being a successful city. It was the capital of the Nabataean Empire, which was on the border of Rome. And there were fights back and forth between Rome. Rome never conquered the Nabataeans, and this was their capital. So when you get down through the Sig, this is the first major building you see. It's called the Treasury. And it just gives you an idea of the perspective, the people in the bottom there. And what they did is they started carving from the top and they worked their way down. You can see up the left-hand, oh no, you can't see it very well. Those are the little tiny holes running up there. That's where they climbed up the side. Oh, you can see it better on this side. This round thing at the top's got a lot of bullet holes in it. They believed because it was the treasury that there was going to be treasure hidden in there. So the local Bedouins would take pot shots at it with their rifles and things, hoping to break it open and get some treasure out, but it's solid rock. As a rule of thumb, you know, if when you're traveling in the Middle East, if someone offers you a donkey or a horse or a camel or something, probably a good idea to take it because there's a reason why. And because it's so many kilometers and it's hot desert and there's a few hundred steps if you're going all the way up to the monastery at the far end, it's well worth taking the donkey. So the next day we left Petra and went through the hills of Moab. And if it wasn't for the bit of tar seal in the foreground, I reckon this picture is probably the same as how it was thousands of years ago. You've got these flocks of sheep with goats and donkeys mixed in. You know, so separating the sheep and the goats kind of came to me when I saw this flock crossing the road. So we went down to an area called Wadi Rum, which is this big valley in the desert, and this is a Bedouin tent. The material that the tent's made of, I found, was quite interesting. It sort of reminded me of the old army blankets. It's woven out of a mixture of wool and goat hair, so it's quite coarse and fairly thick sort of strands, and so it breathes in the summer sun. You know, when you're inside, you can see little bits of daylight through all the holes. But they tell me when it rains, it swells and seals up, so it works well in the wet and the dry. This is inside the tent. The young guy there was our tour guide for the Wadi Rum. He's a Bedouin, and the black man in the nice suit, he was our taxi driver who'd picked us up from Amman and was taking us right through to the Israeli border. He's actually an Ethiopian but lives in Jordan. So this is on the fire there, they're brewing a sweet tea. This is our transport round Wadi Rum. You see a lot of these four-wheel drive Toyotas through the Middle East. Right, so we went right down to, I washed my feet in the Sea of Aquaba there, and when we'd crossed over into Israel, and then we met with a prearranged Jewish taxi driver who took us from Eilat right up to Jerusalem. So going from the Sea of Aquaba, we actually went downhill from sea level, because if you look at the cross section at the top there, you see the Dead Sea is about 300 meters below sea level. It's the lowest point on the surface of the earth. So we traveled from, we followed the, this is part of the Rift Valley that runs right down through through Africa, you know, through Kenya and so on. So you can see in the cross section there, Jordan is up on the plateau on the right hand side of the Dead Sea, and the boundary between Jordan and Israel runs up the Jordan River in the middle there. And Israel has got this big mountain range running up the middle, and then there's the coastal plains. So most of the people live on the coastal plains around Tel Aviv and up the coast. Then you get to Jerusalem. This is your typical sort of shot of Jerusalem. Like, I've got the big poster over there, which is taken from the same vantage point on the Mount of Olives, looking west to the Old City. And of course, the dominant thing on the skyline is that gold dome of the Dome of the Rock. So we're looking across. This real estate in the foreground, is, I was telling Ledger, is the most expensive real estate on earth. To get a burial plot here, you pay more per square meter than anywhere else on the planet, because the Jews want to be there, because Jesus, or their Messiah, is to return on the Mount of Olives and go through the Golden Gate into the temple. This is so the first evening we went for a walk down to the old city. This is the city walls, and they had some art and sort of light displays which were quite modern and interesting. And then this is walking down to the Jaffa Gate. Now there's another famous wall that's more recent, and that's this barrier between the Jewish areas and the Palestinian areas. So this security wall has been very effective at reducing the suicide bombings over the last 15 years. But on the downside, it's made it very hard for the people living in the communities on the other side that work in Jerusalem. Like, the road used to go straight through here behind that truck into the Palestinian areas. But because that particular area was where a lot of the suicide bombers came, the Jews didn't put a checkpoint there. So it's unfortunate that they, you know, they punish everyone, you know, and they could really have put a checkpoint there, I think. So I climbed around the top of the wall, right round the old wall of the old city, and you get a perspective of the city from up on top. You can tell what part of the city you're looking at by what's on the roofs of the buildings. So you can tell this is a Jewish quarter, because the hot water tanks are white, and the black ones over on the, oh, you can't, there's some little black hot water tanks on the roofs over there. This is, they'll be Muslim homes, because they buy from the Muslim factory, which makes black ones. I did have a video clip here, but it won't work, of people praying at the Western Wall, and you can see the big stones, and they put the little prayers on the pieces of paper between the stones. And I had, it included people putting on the prayer shawl. We've got a couple of prayer shawls over there with the tassels on it, the tzitzit. But you can go on YouTube and Google prayers at the Western Wall, and you'll find probably the same clip that I found. I went down underground at the Temple Mount, and this is one of the biggest, I think it's the biggest stone as part of that retaining wall of the Temple Mount area. That's one of the heaviest objects ever moved by humans without machinery. It's 3.6 meters long, about 3 meters high on average, because it's not smooth on the top, and about 3 to 3.5 meters thick. So it's estimated to weigh about 150 metric tons. Sorry, no, 520 metric tons. It's a massive rock. And they've brought it downhill from the quarry at the north end of the Temple Mount. So I also went down under the city of David at the south end of the old city of Jerusalem. This is one of the sewers that they've recently unearthed and excavated. 650 meters long from the Pool of Siloam right down in the bottom of the valley up to the western wall of the Temple Mount. And this ran underneath the main street of the city of David. And this, in Josephus' account of the fall of Jerusalem, it talks about the people trying to hide in the sewers, and the Romans must have heard the children crying out or something, and they lifted the big stones off the sewers and got every last one that was hiding down in here. When they excavated the sewer, they found a little gold bell, which was off the high priest's garment. Another place underground is Hezekiah's tunnel. Quite an interesting experience. A great place to go on a hot day. Nice and cool under there with the water on your feet. That was built about 700 BC when the Syrian army was heading south towards Jerusalem to attack them. And so Hezekiah got two teams to start digging from each end, and they made this tunnel to secure the water source for Jerusalem so that they didn't have to go outside the wall to get water. And that winding tunnel is over 500 meters long, but it only has a fall of 30 centimeters over the whole length of it. So the water only just sort of flows through. So up in the old city, this is one of the Muslim stores selling all sorts of spices, and you can imagine the aromas from a store like that when you walk past, and quite interesting displays that they do. This is in the Jewish quarter. I just thought it looked interesting and pretty. Also in the Jewish quarter, I came across this shop selling. This is where the shop that I bought the prayer shawl from. I didn't buy one of these handmade ones that this lady was making. Too expensive. I bought, you know, a more commercial one. But lots of beautiful artwork in there and things. This is up on the Temple Mount, and our Muslim tour guide explaining all of the bits and pieces. And it's quite hard to get up on the Temple Mount. They don't just let anyone up there. You have to just keep going past regularly while you're in Jerusalem, and hopefully you notice one day when they've got the gate open, they're letting people up, and you just change your plans and go and join the queue, because it may not be open the rest of the time you're there. The architect that built the Dome of the Rock Mosque, he made this model in the foreground there to show the caliph, and he then got approval to build the real thing. So the original was like the model, and then later they added the gold to the dome and expanded it and put the outside walls on. These are the Israeli troops that guard the main Muslim entrance up onto the Temple Mount. And every now and again, you get some of the religious Jews want to start laying a foundation stone for their temple, and it all gets chaotic. And yeah, one of the interesting things, we had to do some laundry. You know, we'd been on the road for a few days at this time, and came. This was the sign on the dispenser for the laundry powder. Not a word of English on it, and think, oh, how on earth do you use this? So I thought, I wonder if Google Translate will work. So I took this photograph of it, and sure enough, it translated it well enough that I could figure out how to use it and how much it cost. So good on Google, you know. Over on the top of the Mount of Olives is this church with it's dedicated to the Lord's Prayer, and it's got the Lord's Prayer in I must be more than 100 languages, and I found the Maori one there. Down the bottom of the valley between the Mount of Olives and the Temple Mount is the Garden of Gethsemane, and it has these ancient olive trees. They're at least 1,000 years old from a recent study they did using carbon dating. But yeah, that trunk of the tree on the left there is probably over a meter wide. They are really ancient trees. Yes, they do. So from Gethsemane, Jesus was arrested and taken to Caiaphas's house and would have been kept in this dungeon here. And you can see they had holes through the rock, and they've put these black cords a black cord through the rock there and hanging down. And there's others on the wall. This is the garden tomb. This was my favourite spot in Jerusalem. It's a really beautiful garden and has this 1st, 2nd century sort of age tomb that's carved out of the rock. And it meets all the criteria for what the Bible describes as where Jesus was buried. I personally think it meets the criteria better than the traditional place that has the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. There's lots of tombs around, yeah. Well, there's some other tombs in that same area, and there's tombs in other places around the city as well. And they keep discovering them. They found just in the last couple of years, they were putting some posts in for a park over the south end of the city, and the post went right down into the ground, and they had uncovered a tomb underground, and it turns out it was one of the high priests from just after Jesus' time, because they found, you know, the ossuaries, the little stone boxes that they put the bones in with the inscriptions on it, and figured out who it belonged to. The entrance to the tomb here originally would have only been that high down, you know, only knee height. They can tell from the marks on the wall that have been roughly made bigger, and that would have been solid stone originally. That's the stone that fits perfectly with what's at that garden tomb. If it's not the stone, it'll be just like it. Quite a massive stone to roll in. There's a slot there which you can see that has been made deeper by the Crusaders, but it looks like there was originally a slot there for the stone to roll across, and that's the diameter that would match what the marks that are on the wall there. There's also a piece up on the rock of the tomb where there's a bit of iron with lead around it, and that's how the Romans cured iron into rock. At the Colosseum in Rome, you can see these iron pins that go between the stones, and they sealed it with molten lead. And so when the Romans put the seal over the stone, they may have anchored it with that piece of iron there, because it'd be odd that you'd have this Roman system on a Jewish tomb. That's another reason I think it could well be the tomb. This is inside the tomb where the bodies were laid. The one on the left would have been visible from the doorway, because if you go in the doorway, there's an area for the mourners to stand, and then over to the right is this is looking from the mourners' area to the right. So the one in the back left corner, which is the left of the picture there, would have been the one you can see from the entrance through the diagonally through. And that would fit the biblical description of where the body was laid. This is what tourists have to do to take pictures of the amazing ceiling lying on the floor in the middle of this church. That's the picture I was trying to take. Unfortunately, the camera sort of doesn't compensate for the different levels of light very well, but it was a really amazing stained glass ceiling. This is a Christian cemetery out in the south of the old city, and that particular tomb that I've discovered, we went looking for this one, because that is Oskar Schindler's tomb. Does anyone read German? Can anyone read that? Can you read it? Again, I used Google Translate to have a go at translating it, and this is what I came up with. Righteous among the nations, the unforgettable lifesaver of 1,200 persecuted Jews. So this practice of putting the stones on the tomb is a Jewish practice. There are descendants that were saved by Oskar Schindler that still visit this tomb. And what they do is, by putting a stone on the tomb, you're marking it so that someone doesn't walk over it. Yad Vashem is the Holocaust Museum, and that is an amazing place. I spent a whole morning there. This is one of the rail cars that took people to the concentration camps. And this is inside Yad Vashem, some of the records and the pictures of the people. It's a huge museum, and big grounds and everything. Out in the grounds, one of the things they've got is trees for the righteous Gentiles, as they call them, the non-Jewish people that did something to try and save some of the Jewish people from Hitler. This particular little tree in the foreground is Corrie ten Boom's tree. You notice it's smaller than the other trees, and that's because when she died in 1983, within a few months of her death, her tree died, and so they had to replant one. Okay, I did one day trip from Jerusalem into the West Bank area, as it's called, south of Jerusalem there. This is what would biblically is called Judea, and this is Hebron, where Abraham's tomb is. So I did a trip through Bethlehem, the Shepherd's Field, Herodium, which was a man-made fortress that Herod built, which is about there, and then down to Abraham's tomb, or the Tomb of the Patriarchs, because there's six of them buried there. And then we went up to Lazarus's tomb over the other side of the Mount of Olives, and right down the mountain to Jericho, and to went up the cable car to where Jesus is believed to have gone, you know, after he was baptized, because he was baptized just in the Jordan River, just near Jericho. That's the genuine site. But I'll show you a picture of that site, and right up near the Sea of Galilee is the place where a lot of people go because the water's nicer and it's a better site. I'll show you those. So this is the Tomb of the Patriarchs. And one of the, I'll tell you a story about going there, because that was the only scary event that I had on the whole trip. We took a Palestinian taxi from Jerusalem. We chose a Palestinian one on purpose because a Jewish taxi probably wouldn't have taken us into the West Bank. It would be too dangerous for them. So we have this Palestinian driver in his taxi, and he's got the Palestinian plates on the taxi. And he'd never been to Hebron, so we're sort of trying to follow the signs and things. We come around this corner, and there's a roadblock. There's a couple of big trucks and a couple of cars completely blocking the road and a whole lot of men standing there. And I thought, oh no, my number's up. And so I'm thinking, oh, I better, no one knows that we're even here. No one's going to miss us for 12, or, you know. I thought, what are we going to do? And so while the taxi driver's sort of negotiating with these guys, explaining who we are and what our business was, I'm thinking, I better turn my GPS on so that, you know, if they're trying to find us, there'll be a signal from my phone, and I'm trying not to let them know that I've got a phone. Am I going to hide it under the seat? Do I put it down my pants, or what am I going to do? It all happened in a couple of minutes, and, you know, they were negotiating in Arabic and let us go. But if we'd been Jewish, I'm sure it would have been a different outcome. But anyway, that was the only scary moment. This is an interesting site for a number of reasons. One of is there's six tombs in here, right? You've got Rebecca's, Isaac's, Abraham, Sarah, Leah, and Jacob. Now, the yellow area is controlled by the Muslims and is used as a mosque. And so we went round and through here and took our shoes off there and went through into the mosque, did a little tour. And we saw Abraham's tomb from this direction. I'll show you picture of that in a moment. And then we went right out and went round and through the Jewish security, and the blue part is a synagogue. So they actually share the building, but once a year the Muslims take over the whole site for a particular thing that's important to them, and once a year they let the Jews take over the whole site, and the Jews get to have access to these other ones. So they can share when they want to, you know? And that's what I found fascinating. So this is inside the mosque part. These are the two tombs that the Jews don't normally get access to. And this is Abraham's tomb on the right, with this green cover over it with all the Arabic stuff. And you're looking through a window towards the Jewish synagogue, right? So then we went round the other side through the Jewish part, and this is that same window looking back into the Muslim side. Back in Jerusalem, we went to an Ethiopian restaurant. It's quite an Ethiopian community there. They're one of the six groups that share the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. They've got the rooftop, and they've built a church on the roof of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is, you know, the traditional place where Jesus was killed and buried. So we went to this Ethiopian restaurant and ordered this meal. I'm trying not to choke there, because you really can't see it very well. This grey stuff, it looks like foam underlay, like you have under carpet. And it has the same sort of texture and not much better taste. It's a really weird thing. And you just take bits of it and you dip it in and we had like half a dozen different dips. The dips were yummy, but this grey stuff. And Peter was remarking that it looked like, you know, carpet underlay. And that's why I'm trying not to choke, because I'm laughing at his comment. But yeah, so we tried all sorts of things. It was a great experience. So I'd spent a whole week in Jerusalem, which was, even though, because I was just doing this, I didn't explain, but I was just with Julia's brother. There were just the two of us traveling together. And he'd been to Israel more than a dozen times before, but we still managed to go to a few places that he hadn't visited before. But the neat thing about doing a personal tour, just the two of us like that, is we're able to see a lot more in a shorter time, because you're not waiting for people to get on and off buses and to, you know, the stragglers that stay in the restaurant too long and, you know, all that sort of thing. So I probably saw twice as much as I would have if I'd been on a bus tour, you know. And if I liked a place, we stayed longer, and if I didn't, well, we just up and left and went to the next one, you know. So it was great. So after we spent a whole week in Jerusalem, then we went down to the Dead Sea and went via, there's a monastery in the cliffs halfway down the mountain there, St. George's Monastery. I went in there, and right down the bottom of the mountain, this is Qumran, which is where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. This is the Dead Sea. That's a fascinating community, and the whole story of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Then En Gedi is a spring in the mountain here that runs down into the Dead Sea. That's where David wrote some of the Psalms. That's where he was hiding in caves from Saul. And further south, you've got the Masada Fortress. And then we stayed at a hotel down on the edge of the southern lake of the Dead Sea down there. So let's have a look at a couple of pictures of that. So this is looking from the village of Qumran over at where these are some of the caves. There's caves in here that the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in. And to get into those caves, they had to be on a rope down from the top. You know, they're quite inaccessible, which is probably why they'd been undiscovered for the best part of 2,000 years. This is one of the copies of the Isaiah scrolls that were found there. There's one on display at a special museum in Jerusalem called the something of the book, which is just across the road from the Israeli Museum. So these scrolls were rolled up and in pottery jars, you know, with lids on them. This is at En Gedi. So I'm reading one of the Psalms that David wrote, and he may well have sat right there when he wrote it. It's, you know, what Jeff was saying, you know, you go to these places where things like this happened, and behind me is a cave that he could have sheltered in for the night, you know. This is the Masada fortress. Looking from the bottom up, the cable car goes up to that. Oh, yeah. This is an aerial shot of the Masada fortress. This is a palace that Herod the Great built, and there's a little path running around there that you get down to it. And this is the main Masada fortress. These big storehouses had all the food. They had like 3 years worth of food stored in these massive storage rooms. And they captured all the water into cisterns and even springs down the side of the thing. They captured every bit of water they could, because of course that was one of the limiting factors to being able to withhold a siege. So the top of Masada is about 500 meters by 300 meters, so it's quite a big site, and it's in the middle of the desert, and it's really hot up there. We were lucky; it was only about 32 degrees of the day we went up there, but it's not uncommon to be 50 degrees in the middle of summer. You know, we were at the beginning of summer. This is Masada on the left here, the top of Masada up there. You can sort of see an outline of lines here in the desert. That was one of the Roman camps when they were laying a siege to the Masada. There was another one over there. They went right, they had camps all the way around Masada. And what the Romans did to get rid, you know, to try and get into the Masada here was they built this is a man-made ramp built by Jewish slaves. And the people, you know, the zealots and so forth that had taken the top of Masada and were trying to withhold from the siege of the Romans, this is after the fall of Jerusalem, so 73 AD. So the defenders chose not to kill their fellow Jews who were being forced to build the ramp, and they knew it was only a matter of time before the Romans would break in. But 960 Jews committed suicide just the day before the Romans broke through. Only two women and five children were alive when the Romans broke through. It's kind of symbolic of Jewish resistance is how the Jews look at it and revere the place. It's a marker point for 394 meters below sea level, down by the Dead Sea. And as many of you will know, floating in the Dead Sea, because there's so much salt in it, you float quite high out of the water. In fact, if you've got any little graze or cut, the salt stings really badly. And after having traipsed around En Gedi and Masada, you know, you didn't realize you had little grazes from your trousers rubbing your leg, but you certainly found them when you got in the salt. But there's big chunks of salt on the edge of the lake, you know, where they've just sort of where the salt just settles out. So we had a night there at the Dead Sea, and then the next day we drove from the Dead Sea all the way up to the Sea of Galilee, and there's quite a few places we visited, including Nazareth and Mount Tabor, which is possibly a site of Jesus' transfiguration, some of the other sort of historical sites. And we stayed at Tiberias on the edge of the lake. And we stayed there about three nights and did day tours from up there. This is the site where Jesus was more likely baptized, close to Jericho, down the south end of the Jordan River, not far from where it flows into the Dead Sea. So you can see the water's pretty brown. And that line there in the water marks the boundary between Jordan and Israel. And over in the shadows there are some Jordanian military guarding their side of the border. Now the other site, just where the Jordan River leaves the Sea of Galilee, is the more popular baptism site because it's lovely, clear water and a much bigger facility and so forth. So most people get baptized up here. This is the Sea of Galilee, which is about 21 kilometers north to south and about 13 kilometers wide. And that's the view from our hotel room on the edge of the lake at Tiberias. And I went for a swim there too. It's so hot, you make the opportunity to go swimming whenever you can. I thought about it, but no. I've been baptized before, I didn't need to do it again. So the first day trip we did from Tiberias, we went right round the lake. If I go back across the other side of the lake there, that hill on the other side of the lake is the south end of the Golan Heights. That's where Jesus cast the demons out of into the 2,000 pigs and some other things like that. So that's directly across that's Tiberias where we stayed. The deviled ham incident probably happened over here. And so there's Golan up here. This is the Golan Heights. This is Syria and Jordan. See, there's the boundary between Jordan and Israel there. Okay, so going around the lake, there's quite a few famous places around that top northwestern side of the lake. There's the Mount of Beatitudes, which is a beautiful church with lovely grounds and lots of flowers and things. There's the Jesus boat, which there's a little brochure over there. It's a boat from the first century that was discovered in the mud when they had a real drought and the level of the lake went right down and they discovered this boat. And there's an interesting museum with how they preserved this boat so it didn't just crumble away. There's Peter's house. There's the synagogue that Jesus did his first sermon at. Jesus spent a lot of time around that side of the lake in his 3 years or so of ministry. So I'm standing on a rock there pretending to walk on the Sea of Galilee. I sent this picture to Julia when I was over there and said that I was thinking of her. I quite like signs. There's another one on the boundary of between Israel and Jordan, saying danger, there's mines and things there. And you notice that the fence is designed to keep people from coming into Israel. It's not designed, there's not much of a risk of people going from Israel into Jordan. And then we stopped at McDonald's on our trip around the lake for lunch, and these guys were on their way back to their unit up on the Golan Heights. Young guys doing their military service. The men have to do 3 years, and the women do two, and they go everywhere with their rifles at their side, even to the bathroom. And it was just amazing to see guys with machine guns in McDonald's. Anyway, so next day trip, we went up to the northern end of the Golan Heights, right up to the Syrian border. There's a ski field at the end of this road here. This is Mount Hermon, which has got snow on it, and there's rivers that feed down into the Sea of Galilee coming down here, and I'll show you some pictures of places around here that we went to. From the Golan Heights up here, you can see right into Syria, and Damascus is just up here about 30, 40 kilometers away. On a clear day, you can see it, I believe. This is Lebanon over here, where Hezbollah are preparing their, they've got all their under houses and things. They've got missiles stored. From the Golan Heights, the military guys said that they can see places where Islamic State, with their black flag and things, with their binoculars, they can see Islamic State encampments within view of the Israeli border. This is from a fortress up in the Golan Heights. This guarded the main trade route from Israel through to Damascus. And you can that's looking down sort of to the south towards the Sea of Galilee. So you can see why strategically this whole Golan Heights was so important militarily for protecting the Israeli farmland down there, because otherwise they were just getting missiles and things raining down on them all the time. So the high ground is always important. This is also in that same area up on the northern border. This cave used to be covered over with rock. Down in that cave was where they worshipped Pan, which was half goat, half man. And there's a natural spring of water that comes out of the rock there. And anywhere where water came out of a mountain was believed in ancient days to be an entrance to the underworld. And so they are worshipping Satan in the temples that they were built here. And this is right at Caesarea Philippi, where Jesus went 30 kilometers out of his way to take his disciples here. And this is where he said, the gates of hell will not stand, that I'll build my church and the gates of hell will not stand against it. So he was probably right here. This is a picture of the sign that sort of shows an artist's impression of the It's only the foundations of these temples still there, but this is what they believe they would have looked like. And there was lots of statue places in the rocks there that, where they had different deities that they worshipped. So this is the river that flows out of that area, the Hermon River. And those are, you can just see trout in the beautiful clear water there. This beautiful part of the country, it's where you're in New Zealand. It's a lot cooler, there's a lot of trees, beautiful clear water. This is one of the springs. This is Julia's brother who I travelled with. This is a fairly recently built suspended walkway above the river. Really nice walk down through there, and one of the waterfalls at the end of it. Now, it was the school group that was visiting the area as well. And except for the lady with the headscarf, you'd think, well, it's just a typical school group like you see anywhere in the Western world. The only difference that sort of caused me to want to take a photo of this group, this parent helper, if you like, with his backpack, with his medical kit and so forth in there. You can't see in there, but there's a pistol on his hip. We don't have parent helpers with pistols on their hips in New Zealand. So we did a few days staying at Tiberias, and then we did this trip through to the coast. This is where we were staying at the hotel at Tiberias. This is a massive valley running from the northwest down to the southeast called the Jezreel Valley. And this is the valley that people talk about, the Battle of Armageddon. It's the way I read the scriptures is that this is where the armies gather. It's not actually where the battle takes place. And Napoleon stood on top of the little mound called Megiddo and said this would be a great place for a battle. You know, it's the valley has smooth edges coming down into it, so you could have big army on each side and they'd go down and fight in the bottom of this big flat valley. So we went to Megiddo. This is Mount Carmel, which is where Elijah did his very amazing sort of challenge to the prophets of Baal. And then we went up to Acre, which is mostly famous for the Crusaders, who made that their beachhead, if you like, when they took the Holy Land. So this is from the Megiddo. This is where Napoleon would have stood and looking out over this valley. There's military airbase here, and there were jets taking off every few minutes and flying over towards Syria, patrolling the borders and so forth. So this is very flat right through here. Jerusalem's over the other. Bethlehem's over the other side there. Got Mount Tabor, which could be the Transfiguration site, and then over beyond that mountain is Sea of Galilee. This is the Crusader Fort or Echo. So it's quite a big ancient city there, and there's a lot still there. It's a really worthwhile place to visit. I love the architecture. You know, you can tell a Crusader arch from a Muslim arch or a Jewish arch, because the Crusader arch has sort of come to a bit of a point. You can probably see it better over here. So this is a big hall, these massive pillars in the middle holding up this roof, these big arches going in three dimensions. As you probably noticed, I like going underground as well. This is a tunnel that goes under the whole city so that they could move troops quickly from one place to another and pop up, you know, to defend the city. The whole city is walled right round. It's a little peninsula sitting out into the Mediterranean and a little port, you know, to protect the ships. We're now going south down the Mediterranean coast. This is where one of the palaces that Herod built. This would have been like a six-star resort, with beautiful marble everywhere and baths, and there's this flat area in here is a huge auditorium with that's a flat sandy bottom where they did chariot races, and every 5 years they had little Olympics there. Out on the point out this way is where he had a palace. Those are mosaic tiles, little tiny tiles making up the patterns on the floor. So a lot of expense has been gone to building this place. And this is where the Apostle Paul was held for a couple of years before he went to Rome. So we travelled from there. This is Caesarea, where we were. There's a Roman aqueduct just to the north that we saw as well. And we went inland and went down this highway. Here's Jerusalem down here, and Bethlehem just south of Jerusalem. We came down here. They're not exactly sure where Emmaus is. You know, you've got where Jesus did the 30-mile Bible study with a couple of followers from Jerusalem. So we think that Emmaus is here. There's a church there marking this spot at Latrun, which they believe might be Emmaus. And so that's what we were heading to. And we found this museum, which is a tank museum. And they've got all these captured tanks from the various wars that they've had with the Muslim neighbours. And so I'll show you some pictures of that. Then one of the places that Peter wanted to go to was this valley down here where David and Goliath had their battle. And then we went from there to Tel Aviv and the old city there before we flew out to Rome. So this is one of the tanks at the Tank Museum. This is not the very latest version of the Israeli tank. This is the second to latest one, but they look very similar. And there's all the stats about it. This particular version of the tank had a 1,200 horsepower motor, weighed 63.5 ton. But the latest version, they call it a Merkavah. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that's Hebrew for chariot. The Mark IV version, which started in service in 2004, it's got a 1,500 horsepower V12 engine in it, weighs 72 tons and can do 50 kilometers an hour over rough ground. And it's got an amazing fire control system where they can target a moving target, so like a helicopter. They've even knocked out helicopters successfully while the tank is moving over rough ground. So the gun's going up and down and being compensated for by the computer. And they're aiming at a moving target. They themselves are moving at 50 kilometers an hour. And the computer works it all out, and they have a high success rate of hitting those moving targets while they themselves are, you know, incredible technology. It's usually tanks have the engine in the back so that it's protected, right? The Jewish idea is to have the engine in the front to add extra protection to the occupants. That's a little different. It has 50 shells that are 120 millimeter diameter, and they have a whole lot of different versions of them for different purposes, armor piercing or incendiary and so on. It also has three 50 caliber machine guns and so on. And it has a self-defense system that detects, it has a radar system that detects incoming anti-tank missiles and targets them and shoots them down in midair. That is an incredible technology. So it's one of the best tanks in the world. It only has a limited range because Israel is such a small place, they don't need to be able to go thousands of kilometers in the tank before refueling. It only can do a couple of hundred kilometers, but that's more than enough in Israel because it's only about the size of Northland. Only a little place. Anyway, this is where David and Goliath had their battle. This is looking from the Philistine hill, and that stream down the bottom there, running through there, is where David would have picked up his stones. The Israelites would have been on these hills over here, and then you know they run down the hill and do their battle in the bottom of the valley. And this is the stream where he would have picked up the smooth stones for his sling. And this is the end of the trip at Tel Aviv. Well, we did spend a few days in Rome, but I've left that out of the thing today. This is looking from the old port where we stayed in a hostel and looking up the beach. This is the centre of Tel Aviv, big modern city. I packed a lot into 2 weeks. Yeah. So this is my favourite shot of Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives.